Greetings, range seekers, and welcome back to another round of Bendability with me, the Splits Wizard, Emmett Lewis. In this week's episode, we are going to be talking all things end range. We're going to be working on getting the definition of end range, talking about end range training, talking about end range strength, and all these kind of things, and hopefully get a clear one. This one, as usual, in the first season, is more of a broad overview of all things end range, some things to think about and a few things to try out in your training as normal. But before we get to that, a bit of housekeeping. So first off, once again, as I said last time, thank you all for just all the nice comments, words, everything I'm getting for everyone. I really do appreciate them, all the messages I'm getting on Instagram, other places. Also, I got a couple of nice reviews I want to read out because they kind of made me laugh a little. The first review, this one comes from Braden McKenzie in Canada. Hope I said your name right, Braden. I want to download all of these episodes and have them on multiple mediums just so I could listen to them even if the world's infrastructure collapsed and we all got comfortable with surviving like it's The Walking Dead and wanted to work on training again. I can't argue with that seeing as how the world is going. I don't know. I find it pretty fun living in the Kali Yuga and the end times myself, but I'm watching the downfall of Western society play out in real time. But back up your things and back up Wikipedia and everything else would be my advice on this one. My podcast is good, but I'd suggest some survival books would probably be useful as well. And, you know, stock up on guns, but make friends with your neighbors and learn how to farm, Braden. Emmett is truly a wizard, like Gandalf the Bendable. If Gandalf was dropping into full splits while fighting orcs, 10 out of 10 would recommend. I do fight orcs daily, it's been known. My dog is basically an orc at this stage, but how it goes. And where is my other one that I wanted to read out? We got one from Aussie AC. I don't suppose that's his real name. I suppose someone from Australia, but who knows? Emma's podcast topics are perfect for anyone looking to advance their flexibility game. Each podcast goes an incredible level of depth, and Emma's knowledge in all aspects of flexibility training make it easy to follow and understand. Awesome. It's one of these things like I'm trying to make things very simple in this podcast, if you kind of guessed, and try to... We're going to have technical episodes as well, but I'd prefer simplicity over complexity any day of the week, that if we can get it as simple as possible... And then we can layer in complexity. So glad that's coming across. I've struggled with a lot of sticking points during my own training. Each topic has given me a different thing to try. These have been very beneficial and helpful. I highly recommend this podcast for any range seekers out there. Thank you, Emmett. Looking forward to more. Thank you, Aussie. This is one of these things. It's like, you know, as you know, in the podcast, I smatter in techniques and stuff to try. If you're listening to this, I do... put them on YouTube, and I've been trying to put in a lot of video illustrations. So if you hear a technique I'm talking about or demoing, or not demoing, maybe I am demoing, if you're just listening to it, you don't know. But we've been cutting video into the YouTube one. So if you find something, the chapters are marked, you can go to YouTube and you can click on the chapter and go, oh, what was he talking about? Pancake something or something else. And that would bring you to that chapter and see possibly some exercise examples or pictures or video or whatever. So there's a bit there for you to check out. If you've only been listening to us on audio, do check that out. Because, I've been putting my time learning to edit, and I feel you should be subjected to my bad editing. Thank you for those reviews. If you have any reviews and other stuff, please do send them to me, and I will attempt to read them out if they bring a smile to my face. And if I haven't read out your review, it's not because it brought a smile to my face. They're just the ones I've gotten recently. In other big news... Top Secret Project X, which I'm sure some of you probably guess what it is from Instagram, is a go. We will be making some announcements coming very soon about Project X. Project X. I need a more wizardy name for that, really. Project Alchemical Project X. Wizardry, whatever. Something along those lines. Anyway, if you want to be one of the first to know and the first to find out about it, and we will be dropping it first on our mailing list. So if you go to modernmobility.com, sign up to the mailing list there, you will get the heads up on the surprise mystery project. Other than that, let's get to it. So end range is one of these kind of things that it's a word that's used a lot, and people seem to think about it as like, how to describe it? Seem to think that it's a flexibility training only thing. But we have to actually get like what is our end range of motion? What is, you know, these kind of questions. What's the actual working definition? And what are we actually trying to do? And this is kind of one of these things that once we have an actual definition, things will become clearer. So we have to think that, like, in the body, we have certain geometries we are able to move the skeletal structure to. And we can think of the skeletal structure as essentially the hard, you cannot go past this point. Abandon all hope, ye who get to this point. It's kind of that. And the skeletal structure, once again, is going to be unique to everyone as usual. And we cannot tell it what it is. Now, I'm sure some people go, well, actually, we can change the bones. And we can change the bones, but it's a very slow process and it takes a lot of time. So for our training theory and the duration you're likely to be sticking to this sort of training, it's not really, it's worth considering, but it's not really thinking I will be able to bend my femur to a more favorable angle with enough duration training. We can a bit, don't get me wrong, but you know, the skeleton sets this kind of like hard limit of like, this is where you are going to be able to get to, and you probably won't be able to go beyond this point. So this could be the defined or called the hard stop. And this is one of the things you would, some people coming from physical therapy will be familiar with this world. It's like, this is the hard stop. And then we have what would be a soft stop. And this would be the limitation imposed by the soft tissues of the body. And this could also be a nervous system stop, where like we put ourselves into a position and then the nervous system reacts somehow to generate a stopping force or resistive force. And it can also be the soft tissue itself cannot extend to past this limit currently. But there can be quite a big gap between my hard stop, my potential genetic skeletal structural limit, and my soft stopping point. A simple example of this would be like, I can, you know, I have the skeletal structure will enable me to do a head to toe, but I can't touch my toes. So we have to get into this, that the soft stop is something that can be, I always think about it as like, it's a habitual stopping point, or what the body's familiarity point of movement is and what its expectations are in this environment. Once again, we don't separate the operator from the environment. So we have this, that we have done a certain amount of training in our past, or we've done no training, and it has imposed certain demands upon our body. And we can see this in the terms of like someone being flexible. Flexibility in terms of like measuring quantitative flexibility, I suppose, in terms of measuring ranges of motion. It's not like someone is flexible. Someone can be very flexible in certain joints and not too flexible in other joints, as we know. So it's not, and we can have like phenotypes that are like, we have someone who's just generally more flexible and their joint capsules and collagen is more predisposed to displaying greater ranges of motion. Then we can also have people who have obviously trained a lot, and these can be almost synonymous in some ways, but it can be quite like, to give examples of this kind of thing, we could be quite common in, say, aerialists. We would have aerialists who have phenomenal upper body strength, and they might be tighter in terms of what they consider tight, using tight in the colloquial here and not in the body tension sense, than they would in their splits. So you could have an aerialist have like amazing over splits, but then their bridges, because of their body patterning and usage of the body, doesn't predispose them to having a very good bridge. It's probably much better than your bridge, but at the same time, it's not maybe an amazing bridge compared to their amazing oversplits. So end ranges are a weird thing. The same time, when we're thinking about end ranges, it's when we get into the research, it's kind of interesting. And there's I've got a few points on this I want to bring up, that we have a range of motion we're moving to. And range of motion is generally defined by the activity. So if we think about like, I do full range of motion deadlifts. Oh, that's nice. But the thing is, what has defined full range of motion in this situation is the height someone chose of a plate to be and a bar to be set from this height. So my full range of motion deadlift, if I'm like 3 meters tall, is going to be very different to a full range of motion deadlift if I'm 1 meter tall. So it is this kind of ranges of motion in the sporting context can be very, very nebulous to define. In terms of this, we can even think about like my range of motion in a barbell bench press or a push-up on the floor is limited by the bar of the floor. Whereas where my the limitation on my shoulder extension, which could be the limitation or true thing, if I used, say, dumbbells or I raised my hands up, suddenly I can go much deeper range of motion. So what is defining the range of motion? Is the equipment and the environment, is it being displayed in? So we just have to bear that in mind when we're thinking end ranges. Then, as I said, we have this gap between our what our ultimate potential is and what our nervous system musculature is allowing us to do, and nerves and all these kind of things, soft tissue limit. But then we also have our general body morphology limit. And this is one of those ones that kind of gets neglected to be spoke about, that if I'm, let's say I have a really big belly, just bear with me this, I'm big power belly, I'm a jacked power lifter, I'm 300 pounds, I have an immense midsection, immense, and I have jacked quads. Well, in terms of skeleton, I could be able to achieve like a double bilateral head to toe, and my dorsiflexion limit would allow that as well. And I have trained my flexibility. My flexibility and total range of motion in this forward folding is very good, and there's no nervous system limitation. It would allow more, but my power belly is pressed against my thighs, and this kind of tissue is not allowing me to actually express. It's giving a morphological limit that displays as a soft tissue limit to my actual hard limit of what my skeleton can do. So this is one of the things that gets quite important, that having big muscles, it's kind of thing, like if we look at the most flexible athletes in the world and the people who are, you know, display general greater ranges of motion and potentials, they have less muscle generally. We can think of the slimmer yogis, we can think of ballet dancers, we can think of rhythmic gymnasts, etc., that they're all kind of very slim. And this means like, for them, there'll be less tissue in the way that has to like squish and like have the fluid squished out of it and learn to relax under this kind of constrictive, compressive flexion or from the joints coming together. And this is one of the limits that is interesting to consider, because you can get it or you can develop it. Like say for myself in my pancake, my joint capsule is perfectly capable of displaying quite a nice over pancake. I've assessed it on this thing. But I have quite big adductors and quite big hip flexors from all that kind of training. So when I go into my pancake, the limitation is not the strength. It's not the bone structure. It's actually like it's uncomfortable when I fold over, and those muscles that are on the inner groin and the kind of all those muscles, it's hard to pinpoint exactly which, are getting compressed under the bones coming together. And that kind of, it's very hard to actually get further than that without like using a lot of weight or a partner. And the partner is not like, the nervous system would allow it. It's not a problem. It's not like I'm resisting the stretch. It's like literally we just have to squish and let that happen. So we have to think about that as well. And another common place we'd see this is actually in bridges, where if we had someone who's quite heavily muscled on the upper back, it can be quite difficult for them to train the bridge and to develop it in a, I would say, timely manner. It's not impossible. I think everyone is able to display quite a good bridge. But if you're stacked, big-ass lats and big-ass erector spinae, they have to learn how to compress and release under this load while remaining this tensile elongation in the spine extension direction. And that is, you know, it can be a very limitation which will predispose you to feeling like, oh, it's not actually doing anywhere. I feel no stretching sensation, yet I feel blocked. And this is, you know, people, this block sensation is one of the ones we hear a lot in dorsiflexion, like the limit of the subtalar joint being compressed, and this gives a unpleasant sensation at the front of the ankle. And you know, there is these things that you'd say soft tissue work could work here. It could, it might not. It's something to try. But we have these as our kind of end ranges. We have our sort of three end ranges to define. So we have the hard limit set by our skeletal structure. We have our soft tissue limit set by our set by our training experience more so than anything else in the context and the environment done. Then we also have our morphological limit set by like how, what shape is our body and how does that shape express limitations. Another kind of interesting one would be, I think you can look up some pictures of Flex Wheeler, or maybe I'll cut them into the podcast. I think Flex Wheeler and Ronnie Coleman at certain points would do splits in their bodybuilding routine. They could get into splits, and these are big guys in bodybuilding stage shape. And, you know, looking at the angles, I actually done it on Flex Wheeler. I worked at the angles of a split. It was about 160 degrees. It was very low, or very low in terms of angle. But he was flat. His quad was down and his hamstring was down. But his hamstring was like basically the size of two of my legs. So it's kind of, his flat split is very different to someone who was who would be 50 kilos in a flat split. So we do have to bear these morphological end ranges in our mind when we're thinking about what end ranges are and what, how we're actually defining them. The next kind of thing I want to think about is we have end range and the strength at the end ranges, or the training of the end ranges. Now, it's interesting if we look at some of the researches and we think of the strength curve where most forces produce the kind of mid-ranges and at the top range, you know, this, and then at the more stretched range, we have a bit less force production capabilities. And this is kind of interesting to consider that we have this strength curve that some of you will be more familiar with. And then there's the idea of like, what does end range training do? What does strengthening the end ranges do? Does it raise the curve? So if I raise the end ranges, does it raise the middle of the curve? Or if I raise the end ranges, does it flatten the curve? So we have a more flatter profile. And it's kind of, it's hard to find any concrete research on it that's been replicated and clear. But we do think about this idea in training our ranges, like if we raise the mid-range strength, we generally will raise the extended range and the shortened range. But at the same time, do they raise proportionally, or do we get a sharper curve? And it is interesting to consider. Then we have what I suppose I'd specialize. So we have what I would term this strength curve operates, looking at a sort of joint or position thing, particularly in more extended positions, it operates in what I would call our operating range. So our operating range is where the main part of our training would be taking place, because we don't want to be training at the extremes. And also we're not, this mid-range, this operating range is not also our true hard limit potential, essentially, or very close to it, unless we have spent significant time developing our flexibility. So we have the concept in end range training, in what we are talking about, range of motion development, of beyond end range training. And this is what we were trying to do when we were trying to get more flexible. We were trying to educate the body on how to safely access these ranges of motion that are beyond our current operating ranges. And this is where things get interesting, because the idea of strengthening the end ranges, and it's kind of, I have to be careful because I think some coach has trademarked end range training and some other coaches trademarked end range strengthening or end range strength or something like that. So it's, it's a bit tedious, but I need a TM mark. Anyway, so we have these ideas that we're training end ranges, but what we're actually trying to train the body to do is go beyond our end range, if this makes sense. So to give a bit more concrete examples on this, I have essentially two, I'm doing a side split. I have two end ranges in this. I have the end range of my adductors and the muscles that are receiving the stretching, lengthening side. And then I also have the end range of the muscles that are maintaining the activations we would need, so the lateral glutes and the hip flexors and stuff like that. It's going to be personal, obviously, but these will have to learn how to shorten effectively, and at the same time the ones will have to learn how to lengthen effectively. So I hope you're following at this point, this kind of thing. And this would be like, I'd get into my training, I would do my warm-up, I'd do my whatever I was doing beforehand, do my activity, Then I would do my development work where I'm going to develop my range of motion. My goal is to lengthen the adductors while also training the shortening side of things. So this is where we're getting into an idea that I call fractionating the rep ranges. So the concept behind fractionating the rep ranges is much like the idea of fractional distillation. If you remember your chemistry classes, or if you've never done chemistry, you can look it up. Is we have this idea that we apply a certain temperature to a liquid, or we would put a fractionating column in. We have different types of fractionating columns, and we'll use one of the ones where it has different layers, and the different temperature of the liquids will separate out, because some of them will get carried higher up with a hotter temperature, and some of them will stay in the mid-range, and some of them will stay at the very bottom, and some of them will stay in our liquid. This idea of different temperatures separating out things is the meta idea I'm using here, that we have these things we're trying to distill. We're trying to break down the rep range to its most optimal and give it its optimal training that we can get the purest expression of that range out. So what this kind of looks like in theory is that we would have a selection. This is where I would use end range training, because there's kind of argument that end range training is just strength training. And yes and no. And what I mean by that is it is definitely strength training. We are trying to follow the logical rules of strength training, of progression, volume, recovery, strength, working in our percentage zones and all this. But at the same time, we are also trying to isolate the most effective technique for that segment of the range of motion to get our result we want. So to give, I suppose I would give a few more examples, I suppose. So we could say, okay, we want to develop our squat. So we're developing a squat, we're sitting down and standing up. I sit down and stand up, that's what I do in a squat. And I have a sticking point at the point where I come 3/4 of the way up. And this sticking point is caused by my upper back collapses. So to fractionate that rep range, I would pick an accessory exercise that forces me to maintain my upper back in the right position. This could be a simple matter of pull something out of my wizard sleeve here. So I would change my accessory exercise either to some upper back work, focusing on upper back extensions. I could do back extensions, just focusing on the upper back. I could swap to a safety bar in the squat, or one of these bigger cambered bars where the weight is going down, you have to push up against it. I could also isolate this rep range, and then I could do standing crunches with a safety bar in this kind of bent leg position just above it. So this would be one way of approaching it. I could select accessory exercises that target the zone exactly. Or I could stick with my squat and I could do heavy partials off pins at this point. So there's different ways of doing that. We could stay with the same movement, or we could pick different accessory exercises and try train the accessory exercises and then see, does my squat get better at this point when I go heavy? Or I could train my squat directly, but change the variables of the squat to allow for me to go to isolate that section of the range. So I've fractionated it out and I've isolated this section of the range, and now I'm going to try and gather more of the range product, the squat product in this thing, to give it a more optimal training volume. Hope you're following. So the same thing, to give some ideas and how this might look in actual range of motion development training. So let's say I am doing a side split. Everyone's side splits, because we all like kicking people in the head, as we know. And we want to kick people in the head, and our side split is only allowing us to kick people in the shins. So we could do this in two ways. We could isolate the glutes and the adductor magnus and these kind of muscles involved. So we could do something like a pissing dog exercise or an open angle tailor's pose, these kind of things, focusing on developing the strength of the glutes. This and their ability to pull the legs apart, either actively, dynamically, or static active, depending on what we're working. And we could also say train the adductor magnus for strength in something like a wide stance squat, horse stance squat, sumo, something like this, as long as it's kind of in the right range. Or we could do a side split, but instead of doing, let's say we could do a side split, we could get into the side split, then instead of just doing the side split, we could try and isolate the muscle groups on the side of the glutes and use them with an intent to lift the legs off the ground or push the legs apart against the floor. So instead of doing our normal isometric contraction, we pull the legs together or pull the heels together, try to bend the knees, we would try to open the split apart. And this is where things get interesting, because with this kind of idea in our training, that we could try do the more holistic version, we do the side split, we just don't have the mental ability or the mind-muscle connection to turn on the glutes in the way that would be favorable to deepening our split. Or we're trying to do an isometric and we just can't actually activate the adductors. We can't find a contraction direction that works for us. So we could pick our accessory exercises, which then give us an experience or possibly more strength in this zone. And this would then eventually be able to transfer over to our side split, because we would train this strength, we would train this mind-muscle connection, this nervous system facilitation, this ability to turn on the muscles or use them in the plane we want. And then we could do it in the side split. So we have this kind of double stage approach that we could build resources or build options or build experience for the body. And then we can use it in the bigger positions. So it's kind of like what we do in the modern methods of mobility. We give the body resources. We give you, there's, you know, a lot of exercises. We have a lot of exercises, far too many. But just as an aside, like we worked it out when me and my apprentice, Isaac, we worked it out on in terms of just lower body front split exercises using the system we use to generate exercises. We have 512 unique front split exercises in the system. And that's just focusing on the lower limbs. And then we have, you know, if we combine all the torso ones as well, there's probably be bringing it up to 1,000 or so. So there's a lot of exercises. Obviously, knowing how to assess and choose them is very important. But at the same time, are all of them useful? Or do you need all of them? You need all of them. You need to have them in your tool bag. Well, maybe you don't need them in all your general training. Anyway, an aside, just flexing my number of exercises in the wizard sleeve. Anyway, so we have the exercise, and all these exercises will teach the body something about its relationship to gravity and its relationship to free space and how to activate and turn on the muscles and how to use the body better. We could then use these exercises to inform the body about what it can do, and then we would put them back into the more holistic thing. So instead of having 512, the split becomes one exercise. And it's this kind of process that you have to go through. And I went through a lot of this deconstruction, reconstructivism. And what this thing is like, that kind of the classic Bruce Lee coach. When I first started training, a punch was a punch. And then when I knew more about training, a punch was like turn the hip and snap the waist and throw the shoulder and hit the back, blah, blah, blah. And then eventually I went through, and then a punch was just a punch. It's the same for me. When I first started training, a split was just a split. You just split the legs and it was a split. Then I knew about training. I was like, oh, it's all these different exercises, this alignment and all these kind of things, and this muscle group and that muscle group, and this changes to that. And then once you have all these experiences, then you just put it back and then you just split. But you can do all the split informed by all the exercises and experiences you've had to change what is going on. The split becomes like an atmosphere. And in the atmosphere, there's different lights showing, and you can turn on and turn off these lights like a DJ light controller in a split symphony. So it's this idea that if you can't find it, we have to find a way to tell you how to find it. You have to find a tool that allows you to find it, and then you have to find it in the positions themselves. Now, it could be a matter of strength, or it could be a matter of like being able to actually feel things out. And that's very interesting to me, because like, say, I'm trying to think of a good example here. So say if we go back to my pancake. So the thing that limits the pancake, so if I'm tilting my hips over, at a certain point I need to use a lot of compression type strength. So I would have trained compression exercises and isolation isometrics in these planes to develop this kind of compression strength that matches, so I have no static active deficit. But then when tilting the hip over, at a certain point, if I am pulling myself, my hip into an anterior tilt or rolling it over, I have to actually let go of this strength and just let the muscles turn off so they can not be tense and not get in the way and kind of squish. And this is something that was like, it was drilled home to me by my good friend Kit Lachlan. And he has a lot of stuff on this. And it's kind of like, he was, you know, the first place it clicked was lotus position, actually. And he has a very good tutorial on the lotus position on his channel. So check it out. It's about 15, 20 minutes long. One of the key things for Kit and getting a lotus position. Now, let's just define a lotus position and what it is for Kit and what thing is. So most people think a lotus position is putting one foot up on the other thigh, the other one crossed over. For Kit, the lotus position basically starts when your heel is pushing into your lower ab on the opposite side. It's very like bound up position. And one of the bigger limitations of Kit, he showed it to me before he had this video and he kind of explained it, is like, it is not so much the, it's not so much your external rotation and glutes, they play a big part in it obviously, but it's the tension you hold in your quads doesn't allow the foot to sink deep enough into it. So the muscles are too tense. And this tension, this strength, we can think of, is basically limiting the foot going down. So I think in Kit's kind of idea of lotus is like, you want the lateral malleolus almost pressing against the femur that it's sunk through the muscles or in that kind of direction. So it's in this idea. Then at the same time, we can make the argument that if we strength train enough that we get so strong, then our muscles don't have to tense with as much force, contractive force, to maintain this position. But my corollary to this would be that strength and relaxation are different things. Yes, they occur in the same kind of general atmosphere, ambience of a thing, but at the same time, relaxation is a skill that can be trained and has to be trained in a different manner. So this comes back to fractionating and choosing the right tool for the job. And I was just conducting, I have one of my friends staying with us at the moment, Charles, who does all our websites and everything, and we were doing a stretch therapy session, and this session for him was more focused. The plan of the session for me was to introduce him to the stretch therapy techniques done in the more traditional stretch therapy manner. One of the things in the stretch therapy system is relaxation and release and removal of restriction is what we're looking for. So we can think of relaxation as the removal of something, and we can think of the strength as the adding in of something. And he's one of these naturally tenser type of people. So we wanted to introduce relaxation. And he'd done stretch therapy work before, copying their YouTube, copying some of their videos and, you know, some other places. He'd done contract relax stretching. And what was happening for him is his contractions, because he's from, trains a lot of strength training, a lot of parkour, are quite strong contractions. And what we really want in these ideas of relaxing is the hint of contraction. You want to contract, but you don't want to contract too hard. You want to just basically turn on the muscles as gentle as possible, educate the body on what's going, and then relax. And this will give you a very strong contrast between tensing, contracting, and relaxation. Whereas if you tense super hard, just as we know, we will be facilitated to tense harder on the next contraction. So we have to battle this, and this is what gives us our softness. So it's the same in my pancake. If I tense too hard or use my strength too much, then the muscles around the groin that have to squish and compress and get out of the way as I roll the hips over, they don't happen to do that. And then at the same time, if I do too much of it, then as I go in, if I've done too much beforehand, I have to do the right amount, then they'll be primed and the relaxation effect to squish and get out of the way is not big enough to allow the hips to come fully over, and I get a restriction from the soft tissue, but it's the tension in the soft tissue and not it is a morphological thing because I've got big muscles there, jacked quads, jacked short adductors, everything else is pretty skinny to be honest. And this is kind of interesting, I suppose. And this is one of the ways to think about it is like, oh, we need to find relaxation to allow these morphological changes. But then this will depend on positions. Like if I'm, you know, if I'm back to my jacked powerlifter, strongest man in the world, who just has an immense torso and abdomen, then rolling over and squishing out of the way, it's just not going to happen because the organs in the abdomen isn't as compressible as you want. So there is these things to think about and to consider when we're talking about like end ranges and what can actually happen. The next kind of thing goes is like, oh, choosing the right tool for the job. And how do we select the right tool for the job? And that's always kind of interesting. So we have basically two strands of ways we can move the body, but one of them is not really moving, it's isometrics. We can, if we are trying to pull ourselves deeper into position, so we're trying to like actively pull ourselves in, even if we're using gravity and we're in a more passive elongation type of thing. So we're in a vector assisted position. So we could think of, say, a hanging bottom position of a Jefferson curl for simplicity. And there's no morphological limit between my abdomen and my thighs at present. So I'm in the bottom position of my Jefferson curl and I can't go deeper. And what needs to happen is my hips need to roll over. But when I put my brain into my gua hips stomach area, I don't have a map or I don't have something to turn on. I don't know how to tilt the hips. Well, then in this situation, I could go back and perform some type of compression exercise. We could think pike compressions. We could think a bent knee slide to a pike, kind of bent leg hamstring. We could think seated bent leg raises. There's a lot of kind of these things. And the focus on this could be not, say, lifting into it, but trying to hold and trying to figure out, how do I actually get my pelvis over and how do I activate my thighs? How do I turn these muscles on so they're facilitated, that I have something on my radar that I can then turn on or use when I'm in the bottom of my Jefferson? So then I could go back to my Jefferson curl and I could push myself deeper, or I could hone in on these muscles that tilt the hips and use them to pull myself deeper into this position. So this is kind of what we're doing with this end range training. I've selected an exercise. I have turned on the muscles. I've given myself a resource from which to draw from. The resource is now available. I know how to use it. And then I can express more range of motion because I'm working with the nervous system and working with the kind of availability of what I have. And I also have some kind of facilitation, which means I can elicit more strength, the easiest way to think about it. I get more activation potential, more things to hone in on. And this is basically the interesting side. And this is where we can see a lot of very big increases. And you see this on kind of end range strength systems, people who focus exclusively on the shortening side of the joint. A lot of people will have a very big increase in the range of motion very quickly in the lengthening sides. Not because, you know, we could say we've gotten stronger, but we've gotten stronger in a way that I would almost call it, we've gotten more skillful, particularly when we're dealing with like short-term changes. When we're dealing with 6 to 12 weeks, we've gotten stronger, but we've gotten stronger mainly because we've gotten better at driving the body. And you know, the true strength will take a while to arise, and true strength lasts. This is one of the tests, like nervous system and skill fades, true strength lasts. It's like old man strength. It's like it's gotten strong over a very long period of time. They can still just pick 400 pounds up or 200 kilos, whatever it is. They can just do it. And it's just old man strength. Whereas kind of nervous system and skill strength is like, I've gotten really good at optimizing my leverages. And I can pick up 400 pounds, but if I stop training for 6 months, then I'm back to 100 kilos wondering where my strength went. So that kind of thing. Obviously, these are big exaggerations, for example, but hopefully you can follow along. So it's the same with ranges of motion developed using these kind of shortening ranges and the skillful ranges. They will stay if you do it long enough, but the short-term facilitation is very useful, but at the same time, it can be very fleeting. You can get very deep very quickly, and you think you've got it, but you haven't got it exactly for a while. So just bear that in mind when you're using these kind of like very tense, very pulling in. And you know, I use them a lot, so it's not to disparage them. They're very good techniques and they're very useful, but at the same time, there is an adaptation period that takes place. So it's kind of We always think of like the method of progression in everything, but we'll talk about flexibility now, is first I just get more skillful at doing the positions and the exercises. This is the initial changes. This is what happens. I get this. Novelty is a stressor for the body. Novelty will create adaptation. The adaptation is I get more skillful, I get better shooting the target. Boom, done. After that, the next kind of adaptations is the tissue adaptation. Like, this is the kind of thing. I'm separating them out, but they do happen concurrently, so don't jump down my throat on this. Then we would have like tissue adaptations. We know that flexibility along muscle lengths, and I have no convincing research that I've read that convinces me or has shown me what happens when we do very short ranges, when we're really working on making the muscle as short as possible and kind of expanding it. Yeah, expanding it sideways, basically, inflating the balloon. But I do think that there is probably a different type of adaptation that happens there. So we have these kind of adaptations that would be happening concurrently, but they take a bit longer than our skill adaptation. Then we have the adaptation of the spinal cord reflex, so the stretch reflex, which is a spinal cord reflex, which also has to adapt, which takes longer. So this is when we begin to see, oh, I can get flat in a split if I use all my good stuff I know about the splits. I've selected my floor surface, I have slid into it, and then I would use all my shortenings, and then I could pull myself deeper and do some isometrics, and then I can get flat in the split, and it takes 3 to 5 sets. But when I start out, I'm still very high up because the spinal cord reflex to the stretch and the lengthening position hasn't altered, and that takes longer. This is one of the 18-month rules. It's like, yeah, we can get you more flexible to really change your octaves and to really go like my working and operating level has just changed and permanently altered. We always think 18 months. So just bear that in mind. And then once we get that, like the more longer adaptations along with the spinal cord reflex will be joint capsule and the ability of the joint capsule to move and alter in response to the stresses. But we're going to ignore that today. Going to do a whole podcast on joint capsules in a bit, so don't worry about that. So we have this kind of progression and way of changing and experiencing the end ranges. And this is kind of what I was getting to more so than anything else. It's like I just wanted to get this definition of the different types of end ranges, and then also what we're trying to do and how our end range training is very useful but can also be detrimental to these effects. So you do have to watch out for that. And at the same time, it's like how do we assess whether we need shortening range or lengthening range? And this is one of these things I always find kind of interesting, is that what I would look for, and what you can look for yourself, is what we would term a active passive deficit. And generally what this would mean is like this is the kind of thing, very, very nebulous. So I would define vector assisted lengthening to the point of maximum weight for a duration in reserve of about 15 seconds as our kind of massive passive lengthening. So what that means in more plainer language is I would go into a stretch, I would select a weight or resistance or a partner assistance in this position where I am lengthening into the position, and I would hold it for a duration of maybe 30 to 40 seconds, possibly even longer. And I would only be able to hold it for about 15 seconds more when I decide to terminate and measure the distance. This would give us a rough measurement of our actual elongation potential. Then I would select the gravity neutral plane of the same exercise or best we can, and try to actively lift my limb or my torso into this position in this idea, or possibly even the gravity resisted one, depending on what I'm looking for in the person. It also depends on your activity. And then I would see how close they would match. So we would do, say, to translate this into exercise, we would do a Jefferson curl. We would go to the bottom of Jefferson's curl and we would hang out there for a minute using 20, 30 kilos, get into it, and we would see where the measurement point of our foot goes to our wrist, to our forearm, to somewhere there. Then we would sit on the floor and we would fold forward as far as we can, reach forward, try to replicate the same position as best we can, and see where we're at. So say I can get all the way to the elbow using some big gaps here, all the way to the elbow in the Jefferson curl variation, but I can just touch my toes to the center of my palm, then we know we kind of have a static passive deficit, or active passive deficit, sorry. So we would go, okay, I have an active passive deficit. So then if I'd done a block of training focusing on closing up this active passive deficit, generally we would see an increase in the elongation side, the muscles or the side of the body that's been elongated in the position without actually having to train it. So this is where we get a lot of the really good results in end range training and end range strength and stuff like this, by strengthening these ranges or building familiarity in training with them, or more skill in these positions. When we then go to do our longer positions, we have more resources, as I've spoken about, to draw on, and we can express more length. Whereas if we are over 80%, so we're close to, like, it matches by about 80%, that's kind of my benchmark on these, and obviously higher is better, then we generally would benefit from more elongation style training, where we're trying to actually train the muscles to get longer and use techniques that would focus on this side. So we might have we could say we have a disparity. So if we have someone who is weak on the compressing or the shortening, or the sides of muscles that are getting shorter, or the muscles that are contracting, and we have this deficit, then by training only one side, we can get both sides to increase. And then it's the same thing on the other way. If our active side masses our passive side closer, by training only the elongation side, and once it gets over 90 degrees or 90%, this is where things get interesting, because if we train the lengthening side, then we're removing the restriction to the shortening side, and we can actually progress in our position by training only lengthening. So it's kind of, I'm very simplifying these things, and it's also a position by position basis. So it's not like, oh, I train shortening only for my pike and then I expect my front split to get better. It doesn't work exactly like that. So just bear that in mind. Well, there is some crossovers depending, using our mobility map matrices that we use in our system. And that kind of gives us a hint of how we might begin to structure our training. Then it's like, oh, well, we built all the resources, but at the same time, we have a massive difference between our starting operating range and our trained range when we have facilitated the range by doing 4 to 5 sets of the movement. There's like a huge difference. Then we know we actually need to shift to techniques. Obviously, we would train our end ranges, but at the same time, we need to actually teach the body that these positions are safe. And this is where we could have a high apprehension response to positions. So this might be key, that we would do less strengthening and nervous system facilitation, and work more on releasing and relaxing into the positions. So we kind of have, you know, three kind of protocols to think about now on the back of this. Then at the same time, we obviously have our techniques. Are we moving in and out of range, or are we doing isometric contractions? What is our intent? What type of isometric contraction have we selected? These are all kind of things that play into it. And I'm going to have a couple of episodes coming up on isometrics, all the different styles of isometrics and what they actually do in the body. So they're coming soon. We'll also talk a bit about dynamics and the way to alter dynamics and other stuff. And then also I have an episode coming up on ballistics as well. Ballistic stretching and pulsing type stretching and short duration and reserve stretching. So that would wrap up the episode for this week. I hope this has given you a nice kind of overview of some of the things to think about when we talk about end range. And we also are going to cycle back to this topic in a few episodes as well, and sort of get into the very nitty gritty of these kind of things and look at some more position specific methods and ideas to think about in this. Other than that, that has been that has been Bendability for this week. Thank you for listening and joining in. Please do sign up to the mailing list on modernmobility.com if you want to find out about when you want to be the first person to know about Project X and when it gets released. Otherwise, you know, follow me on Instagram, all that. Reviews and everything is awesome. Comments, awesome. Please keep them rolling in. It keeps me motivated. Other than that, I will be back next week, and you have been great.